Welcome to the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. I'm Tom Keene. Daily, we bring you insight from the best in economics, finance, investment, and international relations. Find Bloomberg Surveillance on Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, Bloomberg.com, and of course, on the Bloomberg.
Tony Crescenzi, hoping we don't talk to him about Tesla. PIMCO's market strategist, and he joins us around the table. Don't worry, Tony. We're not going to do it.
Do you want to talk about? Do you want to talk about tweeting and driving or Ambien?
Well, I'm very careful about. I drive with 2 feet, and which I tell you not to do, but I've not had an accident, knock wood, in 30 years. I'm a defensive driver.
You're a defensive driver. What is what is a defensive
driver? Meaning my foot
driver?
Being on the brake at all times means I'm. I think I'll be safe against all dangers.
Tony, it's great to have you with us. Let's talk about the market, shall we? Where's the conviction call live for you right now?
The conviction is to go up in quality, up in cash, and up in the capital structure. It is late cycle, meaning the U.S. expansion is entering its 10th year. Once next June arrives, we'll have seen the longest U.S. peacetime expansion ever. And typically, in a case like this, they become there's an increase in risk of recession. And in a recession, of course, an equity beta, credit beta, in other words, some correlation in your portfolio to those markets becomes a little riskier. And so one would want to be to fortify his or her or its portfolio.
So it's interesting. I was reading through your asset allocation report put out by PIMCO. Don't worry, I'm not going to ask you about gold or equities, but I am interested in finding out about the conviction call on non-agency mortgage-backed securities.
Right.
This is basically the mortgage debt that is not backed by Fannie and Freddie Mae. Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. I'm just wondering, from your perspective, how you can have conviction in that if we are at a late cycle and that's less liquid debt?
Well, if you think about it, these loans, of course, many of them, almost all of them, were created before the crisis over 10 years ago. So they're seasoned, if you will. The equity values of these homes have gone up, and the amount of loans outstanding have gone down. In other words, the loan-to-value ratios have gone down. Add another factor, technical factor, the market's shrinking. It's a half trillion. It used to be 2 trillion, so there's some scarcity element there too. But the credit side story looks pretty good right now.
Can we just question the premise of this conversation currently, that we're late cycle? And I don't mean this question to be flippant at all. I just want to understand how you identify where we are in the cycle.
Well, one could look at the calendar and say it's late cycle because we are entering the 10th year of an economic expansion, and that's only happened once since World War II. But perhaps we should be thinking about it in a different way and thinking about the magnitude of increase in GDP. One could say we're mid-cycle based on that because economic growth has been in the low twos, and historically it's been about three. So based on that gauge, in terms of where we should be having seen an economic expansion for 10 years versus where we are, GDP at 20 trillion, perhaps it should be 22 trillion, and there is a ways to go. And finally, looking at the inflation story, which has been benign, wage story, perhaps there is more room to run.
So what is the return expectation that you're trying to set for clients with a fixed income portfolio in the years ahead?
Well, it depends, of course, and at PIMCO it absolutely depends because we run different types of strategies. But one popular strategy is one to be in core investments, the Bloomberg Barclays aggregate. That's yielding today about 3.3%. Historically, managers such as PIMCO have been able to gain alpha or returns above the stated yield of up to 100 basis points. So one could argue then that for core investments in a fixed income portfolio, returns on a going forward basis, since starting yield is the most important determinant of future returns, potentially in the low fours, which is not bad, or even mid fours, not bad for a diversifier. And of course, where your returns are in other parts of the fixed income market depend on the volatility and the type of strategy you choose.
Tony, has income become a much more important component of total return?
It has, because right now the game is not as easy as it was post-crisis, believe it or not. Even though it was challenging back then, it was easy in a sense that if you simply had a beta or a connection to credit and equities, you won. today one has to be thinking more about relative value. And if in fact we could develop a portfolio, create one from the bottoms up, simply looking at the securities and saying we like this security, rather than the top down, having a beta to equities and credit, we would. So we're looking for securities, like Lisa mentioned, like non-agencies or bank capital securities or short-dated corporate bonds.
You know, it's interesting. There's sort of a tension right now because on one hand, people are moving into less liquid securities that offer that income that John was talking about. On the other hand, a lot of people are plowing into private equity funds and venture capital. And I'm just wondering, at what point have we reached direct lending peak, or you know, too much of this that is destined for failure?
Well, yesterday I was in Atlanta, and it was at an alternative investments forum, and some very big players in the game were talking about that idea, and they all seemed to be themselves cautious, and so the yellow flag's already gone up for the big players in the sphere. So it's not likely to get overly frothy. More than likely. And there is still vigor in the global economy, probably grow in the low sixes nominally, meaning real growth of 3.5 and inflation of 2.5.
Yeah.
Gives you 6. And that's good for real assets, which the PE climate and venture capital climate depends upon, the environment.
Tony, just to wrap things up, it's really interesting to me, and I'm sure to our listeners, when we're talking about the confidence and the optimism in the American economy right now, just how defensive fixed income managers are becoming. Dan Iverson, CIO of your shop, interestingly turning cautious and defensive in the last couple of weeks. And Tony, I'm trying to reconcile that with the U.S. economy that we see in front of our eyes right now.
Well, because we're thinking about the late cycle dynamics, and we did put it to some extent in the context of the calendar, meaning we're getting late in the expansion, and typically there is a recession somewhere on the horizon, and one has to be fortifying a portfolio. In fact, the single best investment that you make in your portfolio in the next year or so might be the one you don't currently have. In other words, implicitly, what I just said is that there could be a moment of volatility, whether it be because markets think the Fed will go beyond what it's priced for, or whether markets think that there's a recession somewhere on the horizon. There'll be enough movement in markets that you'll put something in a portfolio that individually will perform very well. But how are you able to do that? By today preparing by raising credit quality, raising cash levels, and going higher in the capital structure. And so we base it on what's the probabilities, and that's what a manager has to go on. And the probability is that over a 3-year horizon or so, these chances of recession are a little higher than they were a few years ago.
Tony, it's great to have you with us.
Thanks, John.
Thank you.
Lisa.
Tony Crescenti, so PIMCO's very own, with some insight into markets, Lisa. Some fascinating stuff.
Yeah.
And certainly compared to the equity guys, whenever I speak to anyone in fixed income, they are starting to turn a little bit more cautious and a little bit more defensive.
Yeah, you know, here's the tension right now, though. You are entering late cycle investing by almost all accounts. When do you know we're in end cycle? And how do you know? And could late cycle go on for the next, I don't know, 3 years?
Potentially. We haven't seen the inversion of the yield curve, and typically
you have
some time
months.
After that, 18 months,
yeah.
Perhaps even 2 years.
Yeah, no, but this is like the tension that I think is emerging.
Yeah, I think it's interesting too. We've run out of time with Tony, but I would love to have asked him about whether everyone is doing the same thing, piling into the front end of the Treasury curve and waiting for the downturn that might not be coming anytime soon. So the tweet coming from the President of the United States saying the following: in speaking with some of the world's top business leaders, I asked what is it that would make businesses, jobs, even better in the United States. Quote, stop quarterly reporting and go to a 6-month system, said one. That would allow greater flexibility and save money. I've asked the SEC to study. Bloomberg's markets correspondent, Romain Bostic, running into the studio to talk to us about it. Romain, your thoughts?
Well, it's interesting. I mean, a lot of CEOs have been pounding the table on this for a while. We know that, people like Warren Buffett and Jamie Dimon have been pretty vocal about the idea of sort of at least scaling back the frequency of providing quarterly guidance. Now, Trump's tweet obviously seems to refer specifically to quarterly reporting as a whole. You know, there he might be conflating the two things. There is a compelling argument, though, that the forward guidance that companies feel compelled to give every quarter might not really reflect the true long-term strategy of the company, and it becomes a little bit of a distraction.
Although I have to wonder now, at a time of near peak profitability, of profitability that really is off the charts, why companies are complaining about this to President Trump as one of their top concerns. I mean, what could it be about that?
Well, look, I mean, anytime we get to the top of these business cycles, we've seen this over and over again, companies always try to push back and reporting requirements and other things that they feel makes their lives a little bit more onerous, because right now they're in the catbird seat. They could point to their job creation. They could point to the record quarterly profits, and they can say, you know, look, cut us a little bit of slack here and we can make this economy grow even more.
Do these individuals need more control? It's my basic question off the back of this. Both Jamie Dimon and Warren Buffett, who wrote a Wall Street Journal op-ed earlier this year, they are both CEO and chairman of their respective companies. That could be a problem for many, many people. Elsewhere, there's a huge problem in the world of technology companies, more and more companies listing dual-class shares that give public shareholders pretty much no voting rights whatsoever. Mark Zuckerberg, this earlier this year, is a fantastic example, perhaps, of a leader with too much control.
Yeah, and I mean, look, I mean, we've talked a lot about this idea that shareholder rights have really sort of been eroded over the past few years. And I mean, you were talking about Elon Musk earlier this morning. And just, I mean, you think that this isn't just about Elon Musk. This is about board independence and oversight. And so all of the things that investors depend on to sort of assess the health of a company, a lot of that is baked into this quarterly reporting cycle. It doesn't mean it doesn't have its flaws.
Yeah.
But there are so many investors across the board that depend on this, and analysts that cover this that depend on this. And to roll that back, you have to wonder, what's going to replace that? We're just going to be in the dark for 6 months?
Yeah.
Robin, is there a precedent for this from a place that has rolled it back?
Well, you've seen this in Europe and particularly in the UK, which has sort of gone back and forth on this. And keep in mind, you know, quite a few companies over there only report on a semi-annual basis, as well as in Asia. But I would also argue, though, too, that the companies over there tend to be a little bit different. I mean, you're talking about much more value-oriented companies that are in much more slower growth industries. But when you're talking about a market like the U.S. where you have so many hyper-growth companies, and to be kept in the dark for 5 or 6 months about what's going on there, I think that would be, it would just create an era of sort of wild speculation among investors. It would probably create more volatility. I'm not sure what would be healthy here for the market.
The problem at the epicenter of all of this is short-termism. Short-termism is a problem. That's something we can all sit around this table and agree on. Where I kind of differ with the people that are kind of pushing this view to end quarterly earnings guidance is that the CEOs and chairmen of these companies have contributed to short-termism. Mm-hmm. They have given investors little much else to focus on, with the exception of quarterly earnings guidance, because their contribution to how these companies have ran is being ripped away from them over the last several years. Isn't that the problem?
Yeah, and I mean, let's talk about the guidance too, because, you know, I was looking at this past earnings season, and the thing is, not a lot of companies actually do this. I mean, not the majority of them. I mean, you're probably talking about less than 40% of the companies in the S&P 500 actually provide a regular quarterly earnings forward guidance.
Yeah.
So a lot of them can get away with just saying, here are our numbers, and then giving some sort of broader thematic about where they're going. And investors seem to be happy with that. But again, if you don't get this sort of airing of the laundry every quarter, it's going to open the door to a lot more speculation amongst market participants.
Yeah.
And I just don't see how that can be.
And I agree with you, Romain. We should be drawing a line between providing quarterly earnings guidance and providing quarterly earnings. And that doesn't seem to be happening this morning at all.
Sure.
Romain Bostic, great to catch up with you this morning. Bloomberg's very own and one of our finest, dropping by the studio to get us up to speed on an important story this morning, Lisa.
Yeah, indeed. A really important story. We will follow it as it evolves. Another important story is taking a look back at what's been happening in Turkey. With the turmoil continuing today, the lira taking another leg lower versus the dollar. The key question here is, how much is this an idiosyncratic issue, and how much does this represent some serious pain that is yet to be felt in the emerging market? It's complex. There's a question, especially as we talk about how the U.S. deficit is continuing to deepen and will probably expand by more than $1 trillion over the next decade. Where are the bond vigilantes? Here to talk with us about that is the person who coined the phrase himself, bond vigilantes back in the 1980s, Dr. Ed Yardeni, president of Yardeni Research, who cut his teeth at a variety of places, including the Federal Reserve and Prudential Securities and Deutsche Bank. Where are they? Why are we not seeing yields go higher in U.S. debt markets, given how much debt the U.S. is selling?
Yeah, these days, if you want to find bond vigilantes, you probably have to go to Turkey or Italy to see how the financial markets are responding to policy mistakes. But here in the United States, you're absolutely right. Since the tax cuts at the end of last year and the spending increases at the beginning of this year, the outlook is for deficits to be $1 trillion a year over the next 10 years on average. So that's huge numbers. And the bond market just doesn't seem to care. And I think the vigilantes are not really the only players in the bond market. There's also central banks, by the way, that for the past 10 years have been muscling into their territory. And you've got the ECB and the BOJ with interest rates slightly negative and bond yields over there close to zero.
Can we glean any lesson from what we're seeing in Italy as far as when the central bank backstop no longer works?
Well, sure. I mean, it's conceivable that the central bankers don't have all the magic in the world. They've certainly thrown a lot of fairy dust at the global economy for 10 years, and it actually seems to, with the benefit of hindsight, worked pretty well. Here we are with out of global recession, the economy is still growing. I mean, at some point the deficits may matter, but I'm very empirical about these things. When I start to see the bond vigilantes kind of rise up and the protest, the outlook for debt, I'll be concerned. I think the bond vigilantes are first and foremost focused on inflation. So I found historically, and I've been doing this for 40 years, the bond market just doesn't seem to be explainable that much by supply-demand fundamentals. So deficits just don't seem to matter until they matter, and they typically matter when one way or another, they're contributing to an inflation problem.
So the concept of a bond vigilante was brilliant, and so we should apply it across a variety of different assets. This morning, President Trump tweeted that the SEC should study allowing companies to report earnings on a half-year basis rather than a quarterly basis. And I'm wondering, are we going to see Dow vigilantes and S&P vigilantes kind of spring up in response to that and say, no way, we want the transparency?
Well, I don't think you're going to see the stock market sell off on this proposal. And even if the SEC said, okay, you only have to report every 6 months, I don't think the stock market would sell off. I think investors, and particularly large institutional ones, said, it's nice that the regulators are saying you only have to do 6 months, but we really want it quarterly. We kind of got used to it. We expect it. Industry analysts are going to be pushing for continuation of quarterly estimates.
Wait, hold on a second. You think that companies are going to say, you know what, we're fine with quarterly earnings?
I think they are. Yeah.
So then why are they
going to say they're fine because the investors that they rely on are saying, we need those numbers. We want those numbers. We expect those numbers. We want a quarterly call, and we want that to continue.
Is it significant that executives who are having dinner with President Trump are griping about this right now?
Well, a lot of people have had dinner with President Trump, and I've had a lot of conversations that sometimes led to nothing more than dessert.
Well, there you go. I mean, I think that there is a question, though. If this is on their wish list right now, does it say we're kind of at a peak power dynamic?
You caught me flat-footed on this one. I mean, I just heard this news like 2 minutes ago, as you did. So I'm saying I'm flabbergasted. I mean, partly because I've got a personal bias. I mean, I need these numbers to keep me busy. If I have to wait 6 months, the good news is I think analysts would continue to do what they do, which is give us their expectations, whether they get quarterly updates or not. And I'll be tracking those willy-nilly, as will investors.
So let's talk about what you do, which is comb through the numbers and try to glean broader trends in some kind of direction. I'm trying to figure out, people are worried about peak profitability as we watch profit margins rise to a record. Do you get any sense that we are at that point, or do you think that this cycle has a lot more room to run than people?
Yeah, well, this has been sort of an issue that's been bandied about recently. There's a lot of sometimes semantic inaccuracies here. What does that mean exactly? And I think that what's meant is what makes sense is that the year-over-year percent change in earnings are peaking this year. And I mean, obviously, with a tax cut as large as we had at the end of last year, we're going to get earnings up about 20% on a year-over-year basis. That's not going to continue. They're going to settle down to the trend growth, assuming no recession, and that's be about 5 to 7%. So in terms of the growth rate, yeah, the growth rate has peaked. I mean, it's not going to do double digits again next couple of years. But beyond that, there's no reason why the market can't continue to rise along with earnings. And if market after this year goes up 5 to 7%, I don't have a problem with that.
Well, one variable here is wages, right?
Yeah. So
we really haven't seen wages increase. And when I talk to a number of equity analysts, they say when we start seeing companies actually have to pay up to hire quality people, then that's going to
right.
cut into profit margins, reduce their attractiveness. Right. But if they don't start paying people more, how long can the consumers keep spending?
Yeah, I mean, you raise another very important question on this profitability issue, peak profitability. I mean, so we could talk about the year-over-year growth rate in earnings, and it's peaking this year, but it'll still grow next year. Again, assuming as I do, there'll be no recession. But you also raise the issue of the profit margin. And the profit margin, which bears have been saying has got to revert to the mean ever since the bull market started almost, that margin actually hit an all-time record high of 11% for the S&P 500 in the fourth quarter before the tax cut. And then the tax cut hits and we're at 12%. So I think there's actually some room for the margin to give some back to fund maybe some wage increases, some more capital spending. But you know what? I mean, we've been waiting for Godot here for a long time in the labor market. Wage inflation just remains extremely quiescent. And I think it's because ever since the trauma of 2008, corporations have been focused on the profit margin.
So given the fact that you seem really positive on markets, and given the fact that we talk with a lot of people who are starting to get cautious, I mean, think about PIMCO or think about a lot of the big asset managers, what's your best contrarian call here?
Well, I guess that the U.S. stock market will continue to outperform on a relative basis all other stock markets around the world, major stock markets, and will do so even on an absolute basis. So, I mean, I've got 3,100 on the S&P 500 by the end of the year. I've been using that number since the beginning of the year. I felt like a genius in January, and then felt like a complete idiot what I'm going to do with myself when the market took a dive there in early February. But now I'm feeling semi-intelligent again.
Now I'm feeling like a genius again.
Not a genius. I don't want to go that far. You know, I always have to be somewhat humble in this business. But, you know, 3,100 by year end or sooner, I've been very optimistic on earnings. It wasn't hard to do with a tax cut, but they're coming even stronger than I'd anticipated.
What about people, sort of the consensus call right now is that we're going to see a downturn within the next probably in 18 months to 2 years. Do you disagree?
For the economy?
Yeah.
I don't know what they know that, you know, that I've been missing here. I mean, I follow all the same data that they do. I don't think, I think, you know, there's suddenly I'm getting a lot of questions about, is this about to become the longest bull market? And if it is, it's because it's discounting the fact that this will probably be the longest expansion next July. And I don't know that, I don't see the excesses. You know, busts are caused by booms. And I don't see that we got an inflationary boom problem right now.
Well, there you have it. A note of optimism ahead of a soft open this morning from Dr. Ed Yardeni. Thank you so much for being with
you.
Me this
a lot
morning.
Of fun. Thanks very much.
Dr. Ed Yardeni is president of Yardeni Research, and he is a longtime market analyst, very respected, cutting his teeth at the Federal Reserve, as well as Prudential Securities and Deutsche Bank and Oak Associates. Right now, there is this divergence going on in the retail sector. You have winners, big winners, I'm thinking Walmart, and you have big losers that have been losers for a long time but are losing even more, the JCPenney's and Sears's of the world. Joining us now, I'm pleased to say, is Dana Telsey, Chief Executive and Chief Research Office Officer of Telsey Advisory Group. Dana, thank you so much for being with us. I want to start with JCPenney because a number of analysts are downgrading their estimates to mere pennies on the dollar for the shares of this company. Why is JCPenney still alive? And will this be the year that some of the laggards that have been really kind of flagging in performance for years, will they finally have to face a reckoning?
I think, first of all, thank you very much for having me on. I think overall, when you see lagging retailers, it takes a long time to kill a retailer. Whether it was Blockbuster, whether it's Radio Shack, or whether it's Sears, they don't go away overnight. With a retailer like JCPenney, certainly for this year, it seems like they continue to have over $2 billion in liquidity, $160 million coming due over the next 2 years. And even at their peak, they still have north of $1.5 billion of liquidity. So it takes a long time. The search for a CEO is essential. Completion of that search is definitely essential. And let's see how their strategies evolve. But also, frankly, what's happening with these weaker retailers, you're seeing others gain share. I mean, look what you're seeing at Kohl's. Look what you've seen at Walmart. Look what you've seen at the off-pricers. Retailers can be cyclical.
All right. So you're talking about how JCPenney could survive even though its shares dropped 27% yesesterday and are down nearly 3% ahead of the open today. I'm wondering, going forward, if you think that any of the sort of beaten up retailers are more attractive than they look to investors currently.
I think one of the ones that's interesting, I think you have Gap out there, and keep in mind 46% of Gap's business is Old Navy, which has been strong. You have the Athleta business, which is growing. You have the Gap brand, which they're addressing the issues. We know what the issues are. And typically when that stock hits near 30, it always is attractive, and it has that ability to move upward to 39. The other one that's been beaten up recently that we think is very attractive is Children's Place. They have a dominant place in the market. They're gaining share. They have done a very good job at inventory planning and allocation and sell through, whether it's online, whether it's in stores, whether it's through Amazon. Their model is very compelling.
I have to confess something, that I shopped at Children's Place for my children. And the one nice thing is it's not super expensive and they have staples. And that sounds really obvious, but it's actually really hard to find. I'm looking right now at shares of Children's Place at about $130 a share. Where do you see them going?
I mean, I think there's no reason why Children's Place isn't going to move higher to at least 150, 160 and higher. I think the opportunity over time for them to be able to gain share is significant. And I mean, I think it's a $165 stock over the next 2 years or so.
Interesting. What about L Brands, Victoria's Secret's parent company? They've been really beaten up this year. Do you see upside there, or is that a completely different story?
I think they're working on the Victoria's Secret business to update and enhance the product offering, update and enhance the brand messaging. They have a significant share in the intimates business. The intimates category is very compelling, and the combination of Bath & Body Works and Victoria's Secret, frankly, allows them to continue to navigate. We do need to see consistency, stability, and an uptick in the Victoria's Secret brand. I think the management team is working very hard to make that happen.
Yeah, L Brands is down 45% so far year to date. I am wondering, though, you know, it wasn't so long ago, I believe maybe even just a year ago, that people were warning of the retail apocalypse that was coming to us, to a theater near you, and it has yet to materialize. And now people are talking about the resurgence of even department stores. I mean, Macy's has seen an incredible run, even with their recent decline after earnings. But I'm just wondering, you know, what did people get wrong? Why are retailers doing so much better than so many people had expected?
I think there's two things that's happening. The strength of the consumer is compelling, and it's not just the consumer, and it's consumers of all ages, frankly, and all income levels in terms of what we've been seeing out there lately. Take a look at the unemployment rate, which has been so low. Look at disposable income, which has been growing. Disposable income, wage increases, couple that with product innovation and newness that's out there that's driving demand. We haven't had an apparel cycle in a long time. And one of the things we're seeing out there, marry it with the government numbers. all of a sudden you're seeing personal consumption expenditure trends. Second quarter clothing and footwear spending grew by 4.1%. That's up from 2.7% in the first quarter. And even take a look at clothing and accessory stores. They're up in the second quarter around 7.3%, outpacing overall retail sales. There's product out there. It's in demand at compelling prices. And you're marrying that with the ability to buy that in different channels, both online and in physical stores, with inventory levels that are clean, so it's driving more full price selling. We have a season that's coming up that should be exciting.
Really, really interesting, especially given some of the pessimism that's been baked into the death of brick and mortar that just really has not happened to the extent that so many people had expected. Dana Telsey, thank you so much for being with us. Dana Telsey is Chief Executive Officer and Chief Research Officer of Telsey Advisory Group.
Thanks for listening to the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. Subscribe and listen to interviews on Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, or whichever podcast platform you prefer. I'm on Twitter at Tom Keene. Before the podcast, you can always catch us worldwide on Bloomberg Radio.